This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to everyone online. Thanks for being here this Sunday, for joining us for practice. I'm here at Jikoji. My name is Taishin. Most of you know that, whether you're a familiar face around these parts or you joined me for beginner's instruction this morning. I'm a relatively new resident here at Jikoji. My wife Michelle and I moved in about 6 months ago at the end of January. Michelle's over there. Hi, dear. And I also have the pleasure, the honor, the opportunity to serve as Jikoji's Ino, which means temple manager, which means I try to keep this place running smoothly with several others. Sometimes it doesn't always happen, but that's okay. And this morning, I want to start by expressing gratitude for the talk that was given last Sunday by one of our teachers, Ho'un Misha Merrill, who's with us, though hiding off camera here on the Zoom screen. In her talk from last week, Ho'un Sensei focused on the Buddha's last teaching, among some other topics. And there's a thread in that last teaching that I want to pick up on today. And that thread is being a light unto yourself, being an island refuge unto yourself. As the Buddha was preparing to pass, his disciples were very concerned. What are we going to do? Buddha, you're not going to be around here to guide our practice, to help us move wisely and skillfully through the world. What are we going to do? Be a light unto yourself. Not too different from some words that the founder of this temple, Hoben Shino Otagawa, offered to a student at one point. Hoben posed the question, if I remember right, who will be your teacher when I'm gone? And I don't remember what the student said. I don't know. My cat, my dogs. Hoben said, no, you. You will be your teacher. And there's something really important about this. And this brings me to the second thread that I want to pick up from Ho'un Sensei's talk. And that's the importance of our direct experience in Buddhist practice. The Buddha did not want you to accept his teachings just because he said them. Not about authority, not about being some kind of supreme, divinely inspired being, and you just have to listen to what I say. No. What he has to say should be confirmed for you through your experience. Always look to your experience. What is my experience showing me about what it is that I'm hearing from a teacher, from a book, from a podcast, from graffiti on a subway wall? What does my experience show me? And so with these two threads in my hand, not literally in my hand, but in my hand, I want to move from the Buddha's last teaching, which was the focus of last week's talk, and I want to go to first teaching, how the Buddha started off on this path with his small group of followers at the time, and the message that he gave to them. We sort of know where the Buddha ended up, but where did he start? That's the question I want to take up today. You can read this first teaching in a sutta, and I'm going to try to say the Pali correctly. Dhamma Kakabapatana Sutta. It'll be the only time I say it all morning. It's not going to get any better. In English, this means setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma Sutra. And the sutra takes place between the Buddha and five companions that he was traveling with for a while. They had gone forth with questions about the suffering that's present in this life. How do we relate to it? How do we work wisely with it? How do we work skillfully with it? And they were trying different kinds of religious and spiritual practices to make that happen. And at a certain point, I'll talk more about some of those practices in a little bit. At a certain point, the Buddha said, "Hey guys," it was all guys. "Hey guys, I don't think this is working for me. My experience isn't showing me the kind of things that I think it needs to show me in order to answer the questions that I have. So I'm going to go try something else." Buddha kind of goes off on his own. And it's at that time that the Buddha comes to plant himself under what we call the Bodhi tree. It's actually not the Buddha yet. His name is Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be. And he resolves, so gripped by certain questions about how to work with the suffering in this life, not to rise until he has the answers that he's been searching for. And lo and behold, this happens. In some stories, it happens in a single night. In other stories, it happens over a period of 7 nights. Doesn't really matter how many days happen. And he wakes up to certain truths or teachings about who we are as human beings and how this world we live in is constituted and how we can relate to it skillfully. And also a body of practices that, depending on the time and the place and the person, can be used as a way of realizing these truths for ourselves. And after some encouragement, he goes back to his five friends. He says, "Hey guys," because it's still all guys, "I got some stuff I want to share with you, some stuff that I've realized as I went away and was practicing on my own." And they're a little bit hesitant at first, but eventually they agree to hear him out because he looks different. He's moving through the world differently. There's a gentleness, a calmness, a peacefulness, a presence about him that's maybe a sign of the sort of thing they've been looking for as well. So here's what the Buddha says to his five friends, his five traveling companions. And it's in saying this that he starts to turn the wheel of the Dharma. These truths or these teachings are starting to circulate in this world. "O monks, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness, one who has left home in pursuit of certain spiritual religious answers, questions about themselves, suffering, the world. What two? First, the pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial." That's one extreme, sensual happiness through sensual pleasures. And the other, second, the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, just another name for the Buddha, has awakened to the middle way, a path of living with the world that's between these two extremes, which gives rise to vision, knowledge, peace, enlightenment, and nirvana. Sounds pretty good, right? So So let's start with this first way, this first extreme that the Buddha has tried, and maybe you've tried as well. I know I have. This is the way where we're pursuing sensual happiness through sensual pleasures. In this way, happiness is attained and sustained by continuous, pleasant stimulation of our six sense organs: the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, body, and according to Buddhist teachings, the mind. The mind is a sense organ as well. So it's by apprehending physical forms that are pleasing to the eyes, pleasing sounds by the ears, pleasing smells by the nose, pleasing tastes by the tongue, and pleasing mental objects, kind of catch-all term, stories in my case about being a superhero, right? Wearing my cape, flying around, or remembering fond times cuddling with one of my cats on the couch after a hard day, that I experience sensual happiness. And what is important about this extreme, I suggest, isn't so much the intensity of the stimulation. Not everything needs to be turned up to 11, as we sometimes say, but that it's constant. It's unbroken and uninterrupted stimulation of my sense organs by various objects. You can think of this as saying, I want only pleasure and no pain. I think that all sounds pretty good to all of us. So, why isn't this going to work as a way of moving with and through the world? Well, the short answer is this constant, unbroken stimulation isn't possible. Maybe you can get it for a short period of time, but you can't have it forever. And part of the reason is that these objects that help provide that stimulation, they're impermanent. They're going to disappear and fade away at some point. So here's kind of a silly example that works, right? So Michelle and I love Oreos. Like, yeah, see, take our favorite little snack, and we enjoy going to the store, and we enjoy finding like the specialty flavors of the Oreos, right? The original Oreo is really good, but sometimes they have like cookie dough, or they've got like vanilla double stuff. Or yesterday, apparently Oreo did a collaboration with the Korean boy band BTS. I don't know anything about, other than they're not much like younger than me. I don't know how they're a boy band. But it's like brown sugar flavored Oreos. Oh boy. So we got these Oreos and we start eating the Oreos. It's really enjoyable. And my taste buds are all like, pa-pow, pa-pow, pa-pow. It's wonderful, right? Then I finish eating the Oreo and that stimulation ends. Now that's okay, because I've got a whole thing of Oreos over here, so I can keep eating the Oreos. And I do. I have a sweet tooth. But what's going to happen? Well, eventually I'm going to eat all of the Oreos, and then there's going to be no more Oreos. And then that stimulation is going to end completely. Or maybe, I don't know, Shoho over here might have a bit of a sweet tooth, and maybe he's going to come and steal the Oreos from me. He's going to eat it. Yeah, see? Yeah. Rats. I told Shoho we had Oreos. So there's just not enough. Now, maybe you say, okay, well, what if you just had like an infinite supply of Oreos? Then you could continue to have this kind of pleasant experience through your taste buds. I'm going to get full at some point. But maybe I keep eating because I'm stubborn. I am. and I just won't give up. Then I'm going to get sick. And then this enjoyable experience is going to become an unenjoyable experience very quickly. It's going to be like one of my cats eats too fast, you know, goes bleh all over the floor. And that's what's going to happen. Kind of a silly example, but it reveals something important, not just that you can't eat Oreos forever, but if you were to try and replace the stimulation that's achieved by the Oreo with something else, that too is going to fail. And that too with anything else, whether it's music, whether it's a pleasing form in front of your eyes, the smell of a rose on a summer's day, a great story. You'll find yourself, if what's important to you is finding happiness in sensual pleasures, chasing after the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, the next thing, to try to keep that stimulation coming. And it's just not going to happen. There's going to be breaks, eventually disruption, eventually. And as a result, your own experience will show you that this way of moving with the world is unreliable, frustrating, and actually filled with suffering. The very thing that you were maybe trying to figure out how to work differently with, you start to bring more of it. And before I move on to the second way, let me just say that it's not all about these objects too, right? These sense organs that I talked about a moment ago, they're impermanent. Anyone ever notice that as you get older, your vision kind of becomes less good? I did. Maybe your hearing starts to go a little bit. Maybe you can't smell things as well as you used to. I couldn't really smell anything from birth, so I'm already way ahead of the curve. But these organs too, these instruments through which I can experience the world, they're unreliable. So I can't always receive that agreeable stimulation that I'd like. So now what, right? Siddhartha, the Buddha-to-be, tried this for a while. It didn't work for him. So what did he do? Well, he jumped to the other extreme. And maybe you've tried this as well. Remember, this extreme is described as the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And here, an effort is made to experience as little agreeable stimulation as possible. Couldn't get everything I want, and now I'm going to try to have as little of it as possible. In one hand, I imagine the person who swings in this way as having an aversion to the unreliability of being in relationship with other things. Can't depend on them, so push them away as much as I can. And in the other hand, a craving not just for reliability, but certainty. I want to know that everything's going to be okay always, starting yesterday. And so with these two things in their hands, this individual goes forth trying to reduce their relationship with the body, with its sense organs, and with everything in the world. And as I said at the outset of this talk, apparently Siddhartha tried this with the five friends that he was traveling with. They tried eating very little. They tried sleeping very little. They tried breathing really little. I don't know how you do that. They sat in meditation for long hours, and they stretched their body in difficult or uncomfortable ways for extended periods of time. I remember reading a story about how the Buddha-to-be stood on his big toe for many hours, just one of them. But why? Doesn't seem enjoyable at all. And toward the end of this experiment, at a certain point, the stories start to get a little fanciful. But one of them says that Siddhartha subsisted on a single grain of rice per day. And I felt relief when Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful Vietnamese monk and peace activist, said, "I've been to where all this was happening. There's no rice there." Okay, cool. Just an example of the extreme way in which we can practice in this direction. And you can see representations of it. Sometimes you see a statue or a painting of Siddhartha, and his collarbones and his rib cage and his hip bones are shown like through flappy, sagging flesh. Not surprising to learn that this way is also kind of extreme. So what goes amiss here, right? With the first way about sensorial pleasure, we found we just can't have it all. Only pleasure, never pain. What are we missing in this other way, where we're trying to reduce our relationship with the body as much as possible? And from my point of view, the answer lies in the belief that somehow I can cut off my relationship with many things. I can try to do this, certainly, and I have tried to do this. It didn't work. What I've discovered is that you just can't shut out the world. You might want to. Get it. But so long as this body, heart, mind is, it's an intimate and a necessary relationship with everything. And that's part of what Siddhartha woke up to when he went off on his own and he sat down underneath this tree that we refer to as the Bodhi tree, tree of awakening. Our complete and fundamental interconnection with all things. This experience was life-defining for him, and it supported a reorientation towards the world. We're not over here. We're not over here, but we're in the middle. What the Buddha would come to call the middle way. And at this point in his conversation, this is what he says to the five companions that are with him. "This middle way awakened to by me, which gives rise to vision, knowledge, peace, enlightenment, and nirvana, is the Eightfold Path, on which there's right view, right intention, right speech and action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration." And it's at this point in his conversation with his companions that the Buddha starts to open up this experience he had, this discovery he made, a little bit more. And that's what I want to shift and just talk a little bit about now. He articulates four truths for us. Four truths I learned that we should understand as truths to live by if you want to be noble. Not noble in the sense of high status, but noble in the sense of moving upright through the world, being in relationship with others if you'd like to cause less suffering, create more safety. And very briefly, these four truths are, first, that there's suffering in this life. You might say, duh. But not duh, actually important. The second truth is that there are causes and conditions that give rise to suffering. We might not always know what they are, one thing, but there are always causes and conditions that give rise to suffering. The third, maybe call this the good news, is that there's an end to suffering. And the fourth is that the end of suffering is realized when we walk this middle path between the two extremes that the Buddha laid out in a very general outline just a moment ago. But I just want to say a few things about this first truth, that there's suffering in this life. Here's what the Buddha says to his companions. This is the truth of suffering, my friends. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Illness is suffering. Death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what you want is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Let me pull this apart a bit. We can start by recognizing from our own experience that there's suffering in being born. Separation by emergence from the womb, a place of comfort, felt safety, and warmth. Those of you who are parents know this well. You can see the child that has come to be suffering as they make this transition in the birthing process. It's no surprise for me to say that there's suffering in growing up. And if we're lucky, growing old. We feel suffering immediately when we're sick or ill, whether we meet with a terminal diagnosis or we just have a cold. And finally, there's suffering in the process of dying and death, where there's complete separation from all that is dear to us and everyone we love. Forever, probably. And from these specific examples, which show us that at every major state or stage in life, there's suffering, we get three general descriptions of how it arises. Union with what is displeasing, like having a cold. All of a sudden, I'm in relationship with the cold, and I don't like that. Or maybe I've done something at my job that my supervisor or boss doesn't like, and they offer some constructive feedback my way, but not necessarily in a kind or understanding way. I don't like that either. There's suffering and separation from what is pleasing to us. I was talking with another Sangha about this yesterday, and the example I used had to do with the beginning of a romantic relationship, right? This sort of puppy love phase, it's sometimes called. You go out to dinner with this person that you're getting to know and you're interested in, and you sit across the table from them, and the whole time you're just going, "You're so cute. No, you're so cute. No, you're so cute. No, you're so cute." Everybody around you is like, "Go away." But this is a really enjoyable part of a relationship. And then over time, I don't know how long, but over time, this period of the relationship comes to an end. And you sit across the dinner table from this person and you just go, "So, you're going to have the pasta again?" And oof. It hits a little different. And not to get what one wants is suffering. I'm sure you know the experience of coming home after a tough weekend, maybe visiting family or at your job or wherever it is, and you walk in the door and all you want is for someone to give you a hug, maybe hand you a cup of tea, tell you that they love you, and there's nobody there. Maybe there is somebody there, but they're not available. They're off doing something else. And at this point, the Buddha shifts to another perspective. And I'll just talk about this generally because I do want to wrap this talk and leave time for questions. The Buddha's talked about different stages of our life, birth, aging, illness, death. He's talked about these three ways in which we can lose what we want, get what we don't want, or not get what we do want. And then he turns his attention to this body, heart, mind. And he points out that we have come to be in such a way as to experience suffering. I have this physical form that allows me to be in relationship with the world. And sometimes I have experiences in that relationship that are unenjoyable. Not through any fault of my own, that's just what shows up. I step on a rock, or I get punched in the gut, or carelessly I put my hand on the hot stove. And based on how I relate to these difficult feelings that I experience for no other reason than this is just how I'm wired, I can choose to act in certain ways that are either wise or unwise. I can choose to respond to them in ways that are either skillful or unskillful, and thereby either create more suffering or less suffering. And I bring this up because as I was working through this first teaching, as I was preparing for this talk this Sunday, it occurred to me that maybe the most important thing for us to take away from this part of the conversation that the Buddha is having with his friends is that while I can't do anything about the suffering that I will experience, that is, I can't stop myself from experiencing suffering at certain points in my life, what I can do, what I have agency over, is learning how to relate to that suffering well. Again, sometimes I relate well and it doesn't spill out over onto other people, or I don't bottle it up inside and cause more suffering for myself and others. But sometimes I don't. I, like everyone else, like the five companions, like the Buddha, are engaged in this continual process of learning how to relate well and work with and transform this suffering that we can't help but experience in our relationships with others. And I offer this to you with the hope, with the wish, really, that it will allow you to feel some more compassion for yourself, because this learning process takes time. It's lifelong. And it's okay if you screw up. And also that you can take this insight about ourselves and our relationship to the world and extend it to everyone you meet, that they too are constituted just like you. They too can't help but experience suffering sometimes. And they too are learning how to relate well and handle the suffering as best they can. Even when it seems like how they're behaving is wildly off the mark. It's a way of saying something that Koben Chino would say. Those of you that were in the small Zendo earlier may have noticed this at the end of the large art piece hanging in there. Tobin described wisdom as the process of returning to compassion. And that's what comes through for me when I read this story. Born from this insight, I can return to being compassionate to others and being compassionate to myself. And I think I'd like to leave it there this morning. I think I have said enough. But thank you very much for listening. And now we have about 9 or 10 minutes for questions, comments, protests. Yeah, come on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm. Yeah, thank you for the question. For those of you online, the question is, you know, the Buddha, being a prince in the beginning, had this really luxurious life where he was able to experience sensual happiness through sensual pleasures. So he got the one extreme, and then he got the other extreme by practicing asceticism. But what about his friends? Did they also have the opportunity to experience the sensual happiness like he did? And if they didn't, is that a problem? Because you need to understand both to find the middle. So the short answer is, as a matter of historical fact about the five companions, I don't know. but what I can say is that experience or exposure to a way of living happens in many ways. So what Siddhartha had to have before he went forth into homelessness, he had direct experience with that. But that's not the only way to learn about something. You can learn about it indirectly too, reading about it in a book, testimony of others, ending a talk or a lecture where someone shares their lived experience with you. I grant you that this is different. And if you hear about a certain way of living indirectly, you may say, hey, I still don't quite know what it feels like to live that way. But about some things, maybe you don't need to. So I'll give you an example, right? I talked a little bit about trying to shut the world out and reduce my relationship with the world as much as possible. I did that through self-destructive drinking. In some spaces, I show up and I say, hi, my name is Tyson. I'm an alcoholic. And, if you have that experience of relating to the world in this way, that can show you a lot about yourself, about others. But I would never wish anybody to have the experiences that I had when things were really challenging for me. I'd rather share as much as I can and hope that's enough to show them that they don't need to try that out. They can just go straight to the middle way. Thanks for the question. Yeah, go home. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the question, Shoho. So Shoho asks about the phone, which has its own maybe addictive qualities to it, and like Oreos or alcohol or anything, can stimulate this pattern for grasping and craving and clinging. And one part of the question is, how does that fit in here with what I've been talking about? Another part is, maybe what do we do about it? Yeah. So in like 4 minutes, here's the answer for everybody. Put this up on YouTube, but don't watch it on your phone. No device. Man, I tried to. It's a story maybe for tea. So so here's one thing to say, right? You can see how the phone fits into this maybe framework that I sketched in the first half of the talk, right? Certainly, the phone gives us forms that are pleasing to the eyes. It'll give us sounds that are pleasing to the ears. And if you're interested in certain kinds of news media or stories, you get lots of things that'll feed the mind, right? Lots of judgments and comparisons and all that. So multiple parts of this body, heart, mind are being stimulated, and they're being stimulated really well. And I'm not talking so much about algorithms because I don't understand that. I just know that you can find anything, right? Whether it's cat videos or the latest shock media about what's happening here, there, or elsewhere, right? You can just find, it's like having an endless supply of Oreos, and it takes a really long time to get full, right? And it's always there. Like, you don't have to go to the store to buy another phone. I mean, eventually, but your current phone works pretty well. Okay. So that's the first thing to say, is just to have an awareness of the many ways in which the stimulation is happening, and that unlike many things, it seems like it could be unbroken, or at least more unbroken than other things. So what do you do about it? It starts with attending to and raising to awareness, a little poetic for my taste, just what's happening when you engage with the phone in this way. And this raising to awareness, it seems to me, doesn't just happen up here. And this is a direct connection with this first truth. The Buddha says, regarding this first truth, this is something to be fully understood. And that doesn't mean just by the mind, but integrated into the entire body and into our relationships with the world. So you can do the same thing here. Ah, yes, I'm starting to recognize the ways in which engagement with this device isn't serving me well, creating a lot of disruption and tension and suffering and clinging and craving and dysfunction. But I really got to see through to this. So pay attention here. Pay attention here. Pay attention here. And pay attention to your relationship. And then slowly, you, we, I, maybe I should just speak from my perspective, can start to set what you might call wise boundaries around the device. And they're going to be hard to hold because, look, I say every day I'm going to turn my phone off at 6. But then what happens? Well, I remember a funny video I saw earlier in the day that I want to show Michelle. Or I know we've got a guest coming this evening and it's 7 o'clock and they're not here. So I got to turn my phone back on and check in while I'm doing it. Oh, what's the latest thing about the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C.? Or whatever, right? It's just a bright, colorful device and I like to look at it. So I can start to pay attention to my direct experience and how it allows me to either relate well or relate poorly. And through all of it, I can have compassion for myself because I'm trying to learn how to work with this thing that is both part of this world, and it seems like I just can't get rid of it. And at the same time, really like to get rid of it. We've got a pond down that way, and even though it would be disruptive to the environment, I would just like to put it in the pond for a while and then take it out and dispose of it responsibly. I hope that helps, Joho. And that is probably all the time we have, unless there's a burning question that can't wait till tea. And anyone online? Everyone smiling and happy. Cool. All right. Well, thanks so very much, friends.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.